All right, thank you very much. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming. I'm Jamie Bartlett from the think tank Demos. I won't go easy on David. I'll probably go harder on David for being a colleague at Demos, but I also write for The Telegraph on technology and have been covering issues of far-right parties and populist parties and left-wing populist parties across Europe for a number of years now. As you see from the list of participants, it's every bit as impressive as the list of speakers. And that's why I'm going to be very, very strict indeed on the time. Each of you has 10 minutes to say your piece. When you have 1 minute left, I'll give you a reminder, and then I'll cut you off after 10, because I want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity during the Q&A afterwards to contribute. Just a quick note, Chi, you have to leave at 5:15, so we'll try and make sure that the questions for you or directed towards you are taken first. And I think, Azina, you're at 5:30, so we'll follow that up too. But there will be plenty of opportunity to contribute. So it's 5:15. Frank, you are first. You have until 25 minutes past. You have the floor.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Ulrich, for having me here. I will try to put Pegida in a somewhat broader context regarding also the recent developments of the German party landscape. 3 years ago, I was invited to write a chapter for an edited volume on right-wing populist parties in Europe about the German case, and my article was called On the Failure of Right-Wing Populism in the Federal Republic. Meanwhile, as you all know, things have changed with the rise of the Alternative for Germany. The AfD was founded in April of 2013. It achieved its first remarkable electoral success in the European elections in May of 2014, winning 7% of the vote. Even better electoral showings were obtained by the AfD in state elections, 3 state elections in East Germany last summer. Support was more limited in Hamburg state elections 4 weeks ago, which nonetheless allowed the party to enter West German parliament for the first time. Starting in September last year, we saw the advent of another right-wing populist actor, a protest movement called Pegida, which brought thousands of people to the streets in the Saxon state capital of Dresden and, with less success, in other cities as well. Demonstrations are ebbing away now, but only slowly. In my opinion, both phenomena must be analyzed in the same context. They reflect a changing political environment in Germany that has created new possibilities for rightist political actors. Work in the comparative field has demonstrated that certain societal crisis constellations, which American historian Lawrence Goodwin refers to as populist moments, are usually a prerequisite for the spawning of such parties and movements. In the AfD's case, the euro and financial crisis played that role. It opened the window of opportunity for a new eurosceptic party whose primary policy demands a controlled dissolution of the monetary union and the rejection of a further deepening of the European integration process lent themselves to the attachment of a broader right-wing populist platform to it. A closer inspection of the party's origins reveals its ability to draw on an already existing network of social and political structures in this task. Upon its founding, the AfD therefore did not have to start from scratch. Attempts at establishing the roots and reasons behind the party's success must, for example, incorporate the Sarrazin debate. Using his book Deutschland schafft sich ab, Germany does away with itself, to advance several propositions concerning the supposed failure of immigration and integration policies. SPD politician and former member of the executive board of the German Bundesbank, Thilo Sarrazin, launched a national debate that held the country captive for several weeks during the summer of 2010. A debate which played an instrumental role, in my opinion, in paving the way for the entry of right-wing populism into the discursive space. Sarrazin continued in his role, as he also employed the populist formula in books on the Eurozone crisis, published in 2012, and a book about political correctness, published in 2014. According to polling data, AfD voters rank immigration alongside social security and a stable currency atop the list of topics that determines their choice at the ballot box, with the three on a roughly even level. While differences with the general electorate are not particularly sizable on the latter two issues, social security and stable currency, AfD voters were more than three times as likely as the general electorate to mention immigration as a decisive topic. The party therefore has a dual incentive to place a special emphasis on this policy area. Compared to the AfD, Pegida is a more difficult to grasp phenomenon. The usage of traditionally leftist forms of political participation by a middle-class conservative organization is by itself rather unusual. Existing observations and studies conducted among participants of its demonstrations indicate strong similarities with the AfD's electorate as male participants, the middle-aged, as well as people with a middle-ranged academic degree and a middle-class income, are significantly or slightly overrepresented. Among those who did mention a partisan preference, the AfD came out on top with 17% ahead of the CDU and the extreme right, NPD. Mirroring this, 76% of AfD voters voiced sympathy for Pegida in a representative poll, compared to a share of only 21% among all voters. The motivations driving AfD voters and Pegida participants can possibly best be characterized through the dual term of insecurity and anxiety. Insecurity refers more to the social situation, meaning apprehensions about a deprivation in wealth, while anxiety aims to describe emotions of cultural alienation, the loss of a familiar social order and its moorings. That a fear of foreigners is not necessarily at its most pronounced in those areas home to most foreigners is not a new finding. If the AfD played a central role in the genesis of Pegida by paving a right-wing populist path, the party could at the same time now be the reason for the rapid implosion of the protest movement. Dissatisfaction and a general protest sentiment held by angry citizens, Wutbürger, as we call them in Germany, have found their way into the party system through the AfD, providing them for the first time with a continuously perceptible political effective voice. 10 minutes finished.
That was eight minutes.
You missed the 1 minute.
I was so excited to give you my 1 minute thing. All right, that's waiting for you then. No one else is allowed to take those extra 2 minutes up, by the way. Can I just get that statistic off you again? About the number of general voters who expressed some sympathy with Pegida. I think it was 76% among AfD,
21%
of the whole electorate.
And if you consider non-voters, only 36%. So
only more.
36%
non-voters.
36% of non-voters, 21%
all the elected, and 76 AfD voters.
Very interesting indeed. Thank you very much. Hold your thoughts and your questions, because we have 10 minutes now from Katina.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here. This is always an admirable context in which one is invited to London. This is really capital of important country. So my issue is Pegida and its political in its political context in Germany. As it was already said, the attention for the Pegida protest movement has diminished, so as the protest movement has diminished. And to start with, although I'm very, very critical towards the substance of the political culture in Germany, I am not really afraid about what happened with AfD and Pegida, because I start from the experience that since the Second World War, we have a more or less constant percentage of 20% in Germany who are inclined to anti-Semitism. That has not changed a lot. We have only about 35% who are clearly against. And in between, we have a number of people who do not know exactly. So what happened here with Pegida and with AfD is a new kind of materialization of a potential of right-wing extremism, which we had all the time in Germany, and even AfD is in a percentage not really exceeding that. So this is not something which does really which frightens me, I have to say. I'm frightened by other stuff, I will tell you, but this one doesn't really frighten me. And also, we are used to experience that all these right-wing tendencies have difficulties to get institutionalized because a very strong motive of them is resentment and hostility. And this is not, if you have resentment and hostility against the outer world, you have also resentment and hostility against the inner world of these organizations. This is always a reciprocity. And we can see that already with AfD, that they are constantly fighting, kicking each other out. And I do not really think that they will have a solid organization to influence politics. I'm not afraid of that. And Pegida also already has lost a number of supporters. And what was nevertheless interesting, and I don't think it would have happened about 25, 30 years ago, that we had so many anti-manifestations, protests against Pegida. This mobilization of those who were against Pegida is something which I was really a little bit surprised about and happy about, because that means that the public, and there are cultural activists who know that that is dangerous and that we have to protest against it. There would have been 25 years ago, there would have been many people who wouldn't have liked it, but would not have gone to the streets to really manifest and demonstrate and to get. So in that sense, there is a progress. And I also think by my former studies on prejudice, et cetera, mentalities, political culture, that in all our societies, not only in Germany, we have kind of a potential, we have sediments, and sometimes they are quite quiet because things are well, and if there is a crisis or something which is more sharp, then it comes up and gets more present into the conscience, and then it goes down. What is much more, I think, dangerous is that within the conservative parties, this potential of resentment and of hostility, in my view, has grown. And this is a problem. We have also recently seen that Pegida and AfD, but Pegida has many more sympathizing people in the Christian Democratic Party in Saxonia than was thought before. So it is not so dangerous to have these extremist movements. This is dangerous if this kind of thinking enters the so-called political center, and that is more of a problem. The psychological reasons for resentment have been explained a number of times, and we know from the election studies in the 30s of the 20th century that it is not the poor and those who really suffer, but it is those who have no perspective in the future, who are afraid that they will lose their status, etc., who are really dangerous, who were adherents of the National Socialists, etc. We are not the poor. The poor were organized with the communists, were organized with the social democrats, with trade unions, but we are not the adherents of the National Socialists. So one source of Pegida is this kind of normal potential of nationalism, extremism, xenophobian attitude, etc. A second is that as well for the political system as for the media, there are in fact problems that are difficult for citizens. First of all, many things are so complex that they don't understand what is happening. Second, our nation states are not anymore able to find solutions for the challenges which we have because they are nearly all transnational, be it climate, be it natural resources, be it security, be it whatever. Even social security, you can't organize that anymore by nation states. And on the other hand, to come together, we see it in Europe, and to have a common political position towards all these problems, which in the time of globalization are transnational, has not yet succeeded. And therefore, I think what is really very important is to find actors and mechanisms for solving these problems. We can see, I would call that better global governance. We can see, by the way, that the insufficiency of national state politics for the moment in Germany, and I say that as a German who has always been German, plays, in my view, a very unhappy and not really a prudent role in European politics and also in global politics, because the first time they are pursuing, and also Chancellor Merkel, in spite of her quite kind of modest behavior, she is pursuing a clearly limited national point of view, limited in terms of time and limited also in terms of thinking what would be also important for other neighbors, etc. So these limits are a problem. And if concerning Greece, the technical political ideas which are important, namely, for instance, that Syriza should not have really a successful time because that would then strengthen the left in Spain for the next elections, etc. This is, in my view, much more important than all what they are telling. And they are telling the Christian Democrats are telling a story about about Greece and the Greeks, which is really very close to a national tragedy, to all that what we know for a long while. And the Social Democrats are not really fighting against it because they are so afraid within the power competition between the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. They are so afraid that they would get a bad echo from the German society because Angela Merkel has such a high level of trust surveys that they really do not dare to do it. So what we need against that are new forms of governance with transnational organized civil society, with transnational cooperation, also with companies, in addition, not instead, in addition of traditional democratic representative politics for actors and procedures in order to overcome that at the level of communities until the global level.
Wow. nine minutes.
So you can use it over there.
Just let me pick you up on one statistic. You said there's a 20%, roughly 20% block that you think has always been somehow open to, susceptible to, or supporting of various types of extreme right-wing...
Yeah, prejudices of anti-Semitism.
And right, okay. So you think this is the same to what you said? 21% No, I'm not saying, I'm not splitting the statistics here. But it's interesting that it was a very similar number that you both quoted, 20%. Right. So the Germans have been unbelievably timely. incredibly to time. So I don't want you to let the side down.
You have two more minutes.
Don't say that. So, Chi, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. And I hope, for a politician to be shorter than anticipated is very rare, I hope I won't take out the whole time, because I should start by saying, despite it saying that I am going to provide political answers to right-wing populism, I'm not. I do not have the solution to that. What I can do, what I would say, is that is our experience in Newcastle and some of the thoughts and the conclusions that I came to as a consequence of that. So, I'm the MP for Newcastle Central, where everything happens. Who said that? I really like that. Yeah, where everything happens. And when I heard in January, I think it was, that Pegida was coming to Newcastle to do their first demonstration, as I understood it, outside of Germany, I have to say that I was entirely depressed, downcast, upset, really, at what that meant for the city that I grew up in. I knew about Pegida from the television, basically, and I also saw part of Chancellor Merkel's New Year message, which I thought was a very strong condemnation of Islamophobia in comparison to some of the condemnations that some of the less strong condemnations that that David Cameron, for example, has made. But I knew that Pegida were Islamophobic, and I didn't want them in my city. And I wondered why they'd chosen Newcastle. And then the BBC reported that the reason they chose Newcastle was because they thought it was a soft target because, and I quote, there were few Muslims and few left-wingers. And at that, you know, I laughed out loud because clearly they had absolutely no knowledge of our city. I mean, it's true that Newcastle, the Muslim population in Newcastle is just 6.3%. which is far less than, say, Birmingham or Bradford. But actually, South Shields, just down the coast from us, has Britain's longest standing Muslim community, Yemeni Muslims. And as I said, everything happens in Newcastle. Muhammad Ali had his marriage vows solemnized in the mosque in South Shields. So the Muslim community is longstanding. It's well-respected, and it's very visible. And when it comes to left-wingers, well, 12 out of the 12 possible MPs on Tyneside are Labour. And for many still in Newcastle, the Labour Party forms part of family culture, as well as being a part of the history, the Labour movement. We have the highest rate of trade unionism in the country, for example. And so, you know, and that's not to suggest, I want to be careful not to suggest that there is no history of racism in Newcastle. I grew up in Newcastle, as I said, in the 70s, and I suffered from physical and psychological, if you like, abuse by the National Front, as it then was, who wanted to make clear that their view, that the Geordie identity was not compatible with brown skin. But, yeah, and I remembered it very personally, that the sense of isolation that caused. But people from across Tyneside and the Northeast, indeed, came together to drive the National Front out from, and they were particularly entrenched around our football team, Newcastle United. And you know, so that they kick. Show Race and the Red Card is a movement that started just next to Newcastle as well. So the idea that we were going backwards to that, because there has also been recently, very recently, a rise in Islamophobic and anti-Semitic incidents in Newcastle. So the idea that we were going backwards, I found quite horrific. And also that Pegida coming at this moment would exacerbate that and make it worse, where the, you know, there were community tensions. I didn't think it was appropriate to call for it to be banned, which is probably just as well, as I don't think it would have been had I done so. But the question was, what sort of response should we have? And that's where an organization called Newcastle Unites, which is a grassroots left-leaning, but not of any one party, a collection of different organizations, different groups, family-orientated, which tries to use community and music and festivals to combat hate. And they took the leading role in deciding what our response should be. And there was many difficulties and complaints, there are different agendas. Some thought that even opposing Pegida would give them too much attention. Others thought that the Labour Party shouldn't be involved. When you ever have grassroots organisations, there were lots of debates about what we should be doing. But in the end, these were with. Also, we had them. George Galloway decided to attend, and that caused a lot of division amongst many people, amongst many of those involved. But in the end, what we had was a huge turnout. People, we had it opened with prayers from Jewish, Muslim, and Christian leaders, and we had speakers. We had speaker Arnie Letts from Dresden, the SDP. MEP from Dresden came over. We also had MEPs, trade union leaders, faith leaders. We had song, we had dance, sounds like a song. We also had our Newcastle United Supporters Trust spoke, and they were very powerful because they were outraged at the idea that any Muslim supporter of Newcastle United would be targeted, or we have a number of Muslim players that they wouldn't be appreciated. And overall, whereas the Pegida rally was about 200 people, used, most of them clearly from the EDL or the Old National Front, five of them were arrested. None of the anti-Pegida rally were arrested. And many people actually said to me that it made them proud to be a Geordie. I should say that people from Teesside and all over the region came, but many said it made them proud to be a Geordie. And the Newcastle footballing chant, Newcastle United will never be defeated, was taken up by the crowd and given a new significance as a statement of multiple identities coming together, as well as the fact that we hope Newcastle United will win a football match one of these days. And sort of in the afternoon, after the event, Pap Sisse, who is one of our Muslim strikers, scored the winning goal. And one of the somebody tweeted, "These Muslims coming over here, scoring goals, improving our football," which was retweeted by many fans as well. So I suppose if I was to draw conclusions, I would say that it was a great platform to show Newcastle as a city that has different communities. It's not about ignoring difference. Different communities who feel stronger together than separately. That collectivism, as is part of the history of Newcastle, can be a populist agenda, just as hatred and division can be. And that, you know, people do care about their neighbour and need to be given appropriate ways to voice that. There was an interesting debate on Twitter and social media about, you know, there were a number of UKIP supporters who said they weren't racist, who went to but clearly an organization who targets one religion is racist or Islamophobic. And I think that the conclusion is that we need engagement, we need strong support for particularly working class representation, which we don't have in this country. But we need absolutely no compromise when it comes to Islamophobia or any kind of prejudice or bigotry.
Thank you very much. Nine minutes.
Yeah.
Super. Well done. Can I just one word answer from you then? In the end, are you glad that they came to Newcastle?
Yes.
It's a positive vote for the right to protest. David Goodhart from Demos, you have 10 minutes.
We'll see, shortly.
10 minutes.
Like G, I am not going to answer the question on the exam paper. I want to, in some respects, pick up populism, or at least make a distinction, which I don't think we've really done so far, between populism and old-fashioned extreme rightism. Pegida seems to very much more belong to the latter. Well, actually, it's sort of sui generis. I think that in some ways populism is a kind of transitional pain, or a sort of symptom of an evolution in our politics. In some respects, it's a sign of the maturity of our politics, the fact that populist parties are now able to operate in countries like Germany shows, I think, democratic maturity. I think in Britain, the rise of UKIP actually is a sign of the Europeanization of our politics. I mean, 2 or 3 years ago, most people would have said, well, Britain, well, not 2 or 3 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, people would have said, Britain is slightly unusual in Europe. It doesn't really do coalition government. And because of first past the post, we don't have a populist movement. Now, both of those things have been disproved. We've had a perfectly reasonably successful coalition government for the last 5 years. And we've also seen the emergence of a moderately powerful populist movement in UKIP. It's not likely to win many seats in Parliament, perhaps 3 or 4. I suspect its share of the popular vote will be a bit below 10%. But it has had, I think, a salutary effect on our politics, actually, for the reasons that I will explain. I think the emergence of... I regard populism as a kind of... as a symptom of a kind of divergence within liberalism. I think most populists are also liberals. I think most UKIP supporters are liberal in the sense that they are Democrats, they believe in democracy, they believe in rights, they believe in minority rights, they believe in race equality. They're distrustful of power. They are modern people. They're not some kind of weirdo troglodytes. But I do think they represent a different... they represent a different sort of social psychology in a way. They have a different set of priorities to what one might call the dominant liberalism in our society, which, for sake of a better term, I will call metropolitan liberalism. And actually someone who's written very interestingly about this is the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, the American, wrote quite a well-known book called The Righteous Mind, and he talked about how there are sort of 5 main human stroke political values. Liberals understand, very acutely understand, 2 of them, suffering and justice. Conservatives, or in my language, popular liberals, understand those sentiments too, but they also understand other things that liberals struggle to understand: in-group loyalty, authority, and the sacred. So just to pursue this distinction between metropolitan and popular liberalism, I do think, and it's a cliche really, that as left and right still matters in many respects, but it's receded somewhat in the politics of most of our countries. And I think new divisions, partly cultural divisions, have emerged, and a gap has opened up between what one might call the secular, liberal, graduate, baby boomer worldview that tends to dominate our political parties and governmental institutions, and the mass of ordinary citizens. And UKIP has emerged into that gap in Britain. It reflects the more rooted and traditional values of the majority, and clings much more tightly to notions of fellow citizen favouritism, national citizen preference, national sovereignty, and hence UKIP's deep suspicion of the European Union and of mass immigration. And this gap that's emerged in our politics is a particular problem for the left. I think it's a problem, or it's an issue for all political parties. It's a particular problem for the left because I think it sort of finally marks the death knell. It's been dying for a long time, but it marks the death knell between the old social democratic coalition, between the liberal middle class and blue collar Britain, and what one might call the Hampstead Humberside Alliance, for a nice bit of alliteration, essentially doesn't exist any longer. Perhaps it does actually in Newcastle, maybe one of the few places where it lingers on. That's because you don't really have much of a middle class in Newcastle.
Not a very big one.
Not a very big one. As I say, metropolitan liberalism is a very powerful. It reflects, I would say, the lived experience of relatively successful, but also caring people, professional people, who have, at least in recent decades, tended to leave home at 18, go to a boarding university where they've imbibed Russell Group liberalism, and then pursued often mobile careers, gone to London, perhaps worked abroad for a year or two. And they have what social scientists call achieved identities, identities based on educational and career success. Now, this makes them generally comfortable with new places and people. Popular liberals, popular liberalism, which I think is still, as it were, the majority form of liberalism, tends to be much more rooted. The popular liberals have ascribed identities based on group and group belonging and particular places, which is why they tend to be more disturbed by rapid change. And I've done a sort of schematic. If I have, how much
you've got?
Have I got
three minutes. Under 3 minutes.
Okay, I've got a sort of schematic list of what I think metropolitan liberalism is and what popular liberalism is now. And many people would probably find they're a combination of the two. But I think it's sort of useful to think about this to try and separate them out. Metropolitan liberalism thinks that change is generally good, although globalization has disadvantages and can create losers. This can be mitigated by wise policy, and they're more winners than losers. Metropolitan liberalism places a high value on individual autonomy. Self-realization is the goal of politics. Freedom is the removal of constraint. It believes in maximizing individual aspiration and social and geographical mobility as some of the main priorities of politics. Few metropolitan liberals are full-blown cosmopolitans, but they tend to favour wide, thin attachments and are rather suspicious of group allegiances. They prefer need before contribution in welfare, equality before fraternity in politics, and they tend to be suspicious of tradition. Popular liberals, by contrast, tend to think that change is loss. It's not always the case, and much of the modern world is better than the old one. But suspicion of change is perfectly rational for those who benefit from it least. Popular liberalism places a very high value on security and stability in living arrangements and reciprocity in human relations. Individual achievement is sought and respected, but the main goal in life is human association and being recognised in significant ways. Popular liberals are moral particularists. They value those close to them more than those who are distant. They believe in contribution before need in welfare, fraternity before equality in politics, and they often think that tradition represents the wisdom of past generations. Now, metropolitan liberalism dominates popular liberalism in most of modern politics, in most of our countries, I think. Indeed, you might say it's captured much of the policy agenda. Where its interests are engaged, things happen. I mean, we have spent in this country vast amounts of parliamentary time in the last 10, 15 years on university reform, because everybody, all the metropolitan liberals, most of who dominate in Parliament, dominate all political parties, they all went to good universities and all their children go to good universities. This affects their immediate interests. And technical and vocational education remains a complete and utter mess in this country, partly because the interests of the Metropolitan League are not sufficiently engaged in it.
Final point, David.
Okay. Well, as I say, when the Metropolitan Liberals' interests are engaged, things happen. When their interests are not engaged, they don't. Like lack of proper immigration controls, lack of house building, failure to create a more contributory welfare state, failure to create a social care system that works well, and failure to create a more family-friendly tax benefit regime, at least in this country. Those are amongst the things I think we have failed to do because... So populism is a legitimate response to many of these political failures. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I'll take that sort of 15-second overrun as being caused by the little fracas about middle class or the lack thereof in Newcastle. I won't follow up with a question because I'd like to get straight to you, Claudia. Last but not least, you're from Policy Network. And the floor is yours.
Okay. So I've been asked today to talk about populism in the European context and Pegida in this context as well. So populism in... I should mention that I'm specifying about right-wing populism because the left-wing variety does differ in certain ways, but given that the topic was Pegida. So populism is driven by three main factors usually, so a combination of economic drivers, kind of cultural drivers, which is where the whole immigration debate comes in, and then a sort of protest against the establishment and the elite and the political system. And all three of these things get to the point of the fact that these people feel that they don't have a voice in the system on any of these changes that are happening around them. So the political and the economic and the cultural changes that have happened over the past few decades lead to a certain feeling of uncertainty and anxiety, as Frank said earlier. And populists tend to feed off of this anxiety and try to unite the people who feel this way through a certain rhetoric by saying, we are the people. So Pegida says this, UKIP says this not in a direct way, but it's always about the people, the vote. That's why quite often populist parties are called the people's party. And the people, though, tend to be defined in quite an exclusionary way, though. So usually in terms of ethnic or cultural characteristics. So it's not just usually about the numbers, but it's also a sort of qualitative threat that immigration, in this case, seems to pose to people. So populists, through speaking in this sort of way of we are the people, our native culture is being tainted by these others, they tend to stoke the anxiety and foment the fear. So instead of encouraging people to encourage each other's freedom, their freedom of movement, their freedom of religion, or their freedom of expression, it kind of tells people to be suspicious of one another's choices. So immigration tends to be the scapegoat for a lot of populist parties in this sense, that instead of looking at the bigger, much more complex picture of how the economy has changed, that we have low growth with aging populations, rising inequality, the solution to all of these very complex issues is a very simple one, that we just need to close our borders, we need to reduce immigration, or we need to coerce a more forceful integration, and all of these problems will go away. So in this sense that, so it becomes a bit of, it's a politics of grievance and of anger. When talking about immigrants, populists also tend to differentiate between the real immigrants that deserve to be there and the fake, usually asylum seekers who come for to milk the welfare system or to take advantage of other countries. So, but this tends to be based on myths and deceptions about the numbers. There's been quite a bit of work done, especially by Ipsos Mori, about this, taking a look at cross-national data, and there's a massive gap in terms of the numbers that people think exist of immigrants versus the actual number of immigrants in the countries. That same gap exists when you ask people how many Muslims they think are in the country versus how many are actually there. And the interesting thing is that when people do actually have the real numbers, their views about immigration are much less extreme. So, but because the narratives that populists put forward are based on these myths and deceptions, it's why people, and quite often people who live in areas where there isn't very much immigration, tend to feel as though their native culture is being tended, is being tainted, or that there's too much diversity in the country that's reducing social cohesion. So this isn't actually based on lived experiences, but quite often is propagated by populists and furthermore in the media. And this is also why we've seen the success of populist parties in certain countries, like in France and Denmark and Sweden, where when we've had the sort of centrist, usually centre-right party, take a harsher stance on immigration in response to populist parties, the populist parties have actually done better because of it. It reinforces these myths and these perceptions that there is a massive crisis and that our society is being tainted, that when people have a view that 30% of their country is Muslim, when in fact it's 5%, and, well, in Pegida's case, in the region where they started, it's less than 1%, there's a massive disparity between the reality and people's perceptions. And I think that's why Merkel did a really good job in standing up quite strongly to Pegida and her New Year's resolution and said that Islam is a part of Germany. I think that this sort of rhetoric and what she was saying is really the right response on this. Because on the one hand, it's true that we won't win the battle against populists just by forcing facts and stats down people's throats. But at the same time, there needs to be a more factually balanced narrative around immigration by our leaders, especially if we do live in a context in a globalized society where we need immigrants, not just to fill gaps in the labor market, but also to sustain the economy, to pay for our aging societies, to sustain public services, to pay for pensions and healthcare. We also need this narrative to highlight the fact that we shouldn't be judging people by their nationality or by their religion or language or gender or sexual orientation, but as individuals contributing to the shared society of which they take part of. So although this narrative, changing the narrative around immigration and about our society just starts to tackle the symptoms of populism, I think it's a good place to start and where we should be going. And I like the last line of Chi's piece that she wrote about her experience in Newcastle, that it's a good platform for sharing the values that we want to live by. And I think that having this value-based narrative is really important. And then finally, I just want to say that though tackling the symptoms by changing the narrative around these debates is important, the bigger underlying questions of what's driving populism in the first place are really the issues that need to be tackled. So I think in this one sense, I do agree that populism can be a force for good if it forces the political establishment to kind of reevaluate the status quo and the way things are running and to reconsider the balance of power between the elected elites and citizens who, to a certain extent, don't feel like their voices are being heard. I mean, party membership has been declining, party identification has been declining, there's been low voter turnout across the board. People aren't engaging to the same extent in traditional politics, and I think that the rise of populists might at least lead to a certain recognition that maybe there also needs to be an addition to democracy of doing things differently to include these other voices that feel like they're not being heard. So part of the research that I'm doing around this at Policy Network now has to do with looking at different democratic innovations, not just in Europe, but in Canada and Australia, in the United States. And I'm just, because of time, I'm going to mention one example that in the Netherlands, the government has recently agreed to fund 10 G-thousands, as they've called them. So what this is a group of 1,000 randomly selected citizens in a town to come together and to discuss the issues that matter to them together with the elected council people who then take those decisions seriously. So there's no kind of set agenda for this ahead of time. People are asked to come into these meetings and they're asked three questions. What's important for you to happen in your community for the next 4 years? What do you think has to happen to make that happen? And what are you going to do to help make it happen? So I think consider looking at these sort of other democratic innovations as a way of thinking about the underlying drivers of populism in terms of the distrust in politics to actually achieve prosperity, to actually represent the people, to have other voices heard. Obviously isn't a one-all solution, but I think it's something to that could help in the long term if these sort of conventions could be institutionalized, because not only are they more representative, but they bring together what the people call the others to show them that actually there aren't that many differences between you as you do imagine. And from the examples that I've looked at in all the countries that I mentioned, that tends to be the case. So more research needs to be done around that, but I want to end on that kind of maybe optimistic note. Thank you.
Claudia, thank you very much. You had 18 seconds to go, in case you're interested, so I just ripped this thing up because I didn't need to use it at all.